Government-issued contracts usually include pages of boilerplate. Contractors ignore this at their peril, though. Buried in all that fine print might be clauses that can burn you. Contracting legal expert Tim Sullivan has authored the blog 10 Myths of Government Contracting. Now, I've been exploring these myths with him. Today, Sullivan tackles the 10th and final myth. Solicitations are filled with standard provisions that don't require careful reading. Sullivan says, to the contrary, make sure someone combs over all that boilerplate.
The real problem is making the mistake of thinking something is boilerplate when it's not, or thinking your contract is filled with boilerplate. And while most of it is, there are some zingers in there that can cause you real problems down the road.
So boilerplate is FAR provisions that are pretty much cut and paste into almost all solicitations. But it sounds like agencies also bury things that matter within all what is considered boilerplate.
Well, they'd probably tell you they don't bury it. It's there. It's just that people make the assumption that it's all one and the same, and every solicitation is unique only in terms of the scope of work and the products or services you're going to be delivering. But the standard terms and conditions that follow those things is always the same. To make that assumption is really a risky one. And experienced contract administrators know that they've got to go through that puppy and see that the language and the clauses, the terms and conditions that are in there are appropriate for this particular procurement. If they don't think it's appropriate, they need to raise it with a contracting officer in a timely way. That is, not waiting till 2 minutes before proposals are due, but as soon as possible, usually in writing, laying out your concerns and seeing if he or she will do something to either address it, remove it, do whatever it's got to do to correct the problem. If they don't do that, you're faced with the real problem of deciding whether you want to actually file a protest about these objectionable terms or conditions before you submit your proposal. That is the equivalent of suing a potential customer, and a lot of people aren't comfortable with it. But if you don't do it before offers are due, you never get to complain about that language again.
And you mentioned that contracts in the government sector are contracts of adhesion. What does that mean?
Well, it means that if you and I were to sit down and negotiate a deal for you to be a reporter for me for the next 6 years, we'd start from scratch. We'd probably have some terms and conditions that we like at the station, but we would start from scratch and negotiate from the ground up. With the U.S. government, they are required to impose certain terms and conditions on every contractor, and they do. And it's not a question of you negotiating, if you will, from square one for these things. Going in, you know you must accept these terms and conditions. There is no negotiating. They are mandatory. So you must adhere to these things, and the ability to negotiate them out is literally non-existent. Now, there are some things you can negotiate with the federal government, but certainly not, for example, the default clause, the termination for default clause. It's got to be there. You can't negotiate the presence of the termination for convenience clause. It's got to be there. Certain socioeconomic clauses that the government is required to impose upon you, it's got to be there. So that's why we call these contracts of adhesion.
And so there's the sticky part of the contracts that are adhesive, and then there are the requirements, which vary according to each solicitation. But somewhere in the middle, there are things that look like boilerplate or might be in where the boilerplate is that aren't. What are some examples of those?
Well, in myth number 10, I give the one that has always been my example in the classes I teach, and it is a provision entitled Contract Interpretation, Notice of Ambiguities. And basically what that says is, here's the RFP, here's the solicitation, we're not really sure what's in it, it might be junk, but guess what? It's now your problem. And if you don't bring it problems with this solicitation, anything in it, to our attention at the earliest possible moment, you've waived any right to file a claim on it. It's just an incredible clause. It never saw the light of day in terms of the Federal Register process that's required under the Administrative Procedure Act. This is one of those clauses that I call a local clause. That is, it was put together by folks at a particular facility who'd had trouble with a particular contractor, and then they got together and said, we've got to put a clause in our solicitations and contracts going forward that makes sure no one ever does this to us again. And they do it. And Tom, just because people just assume that everything coming out of this agency is standard boilerplate language, they don't bother to look at it. And if they find themselves, let's say, in a contract interpretation problem with the agency that's costing them hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars, the agency would simply say, well, sorry, you've waived any right to a claim because of this clause. Now, this particular clause I'm talking about, I think, is unconscionable and unenforceable. And I've actually heard a judge say that in a courtroom, but not every judge views it the same way. And so these kinds of clauses, if you don't knock them out up front, they create what lawyers and judges would call litigation risk. And you take the risk that in performing this contract, you'll never have a problem come up and everything's fine. That's a heck of a risk with the U.S. government, because this kind of a clause, in theory, has the risk of a bad specification, which ought to be on the government's shoulder, being switched or transferred to the contractor. And that is not something that most contractors would like to have. And that's why these things are dangerous.
So if you discover that in a solicitation, can that type of clause be negotiated out, unlike the other ones that are
absolutely
adhesive?
Right, yes. The contracting officer is going to be confronted with a situation where it's certainly not a clause out of the Federal Acquisition Regulation. It's not out of the Defense Department FAR supplement or any agency FAR supplement. And it hasn't gone through the formal rulemaking process required by the Administrative Procedure Act. So if a smart contracting officer is confronted with someone raising concerns about this before proposals are due, he or she's going to toss this clause out. I've actually had it done in my career, where I've had our clients just call the contracting officer, raise their concerns about it, and they've dropped the clause.
We're speaking with Tim Sullivan. He's a partner at Thompson Coburn. And I guess this is a related but not quite parallel issue, is that some federal agencies have exemptions from the FAR, or they may have their own system that's modeled on the FAR. I'm thinking of an agency like the FAA, where the boilerplate might be very different from a full FAR agency.
Well, exactly. The Postal Service and the FAA are the two primary examples of this. They have their own procurement system. They have their own forums for resolving protests and disputes and claims. And my gosh, if you compare either the Postal Service or the FAA's procurement regulations to the FAR, it's laughable. The FAR is, 2 inches thick in its printed format. The FAA's and the Postal Service is, if it's a quarter of an inch, I'm probably exaggerating. I mean, it's basically very broad. And it's brilliant in that sense, in the sense that it's these regulations are so broadly written that they confer incredible amounts of discretion on a contracting officer and a contracting agency, giving them much more latitude to maneuver. And they're very happy with those two systems at those two agencies.
And if you're in construction, different agencies have different authorities to do construction, GSA mostly on behalf of the civilian agencies, but also the Army Corps of Engineer. State Department has its own construction authority. So it may be that you're going to get widely differing boilerplate among those agencies if you're in any of those trades.
Well, I actually haven't seen that. What I've seen is, with all three of those agencies, they're covered by the FAR and the applicable FAR supplements, and the only thing they do have is construction-specific clauses. And there are, as many of the listeners know, there are many clauses that are only in construction contracts. We don't see them in production or service contracts. For example, differing site conditions. These are the kinds of clauses that really work in a contractor's favor if they understand the nature of the clause. That is, recognizing a differing site condition, bringing it to the agency's attention at the earliest possible moment, and then documenting the situation so the parties can work things out. But they are construction specific, and the construction contractors out there with any experience are masters at these things and understanding how they work.
Because a big contractor in Aurora, Colorado, that was trying to build a VA hospital walked off the job, and they were supported by one of the appeals courts, one of the contract dispute courts, said that the VA is the one that acted in bad faith.
That decision, which just came down, was a joint venture. It involved a joint venture on a VA hospital out there. I read the decision about a week ago. I think it came out from the Civilian Board of Contract Appeals, and it's a doozy. And you don't see the judges using the words bad faith very often, but the Chief Judge Daniels found bad faith in this case. It's a real slap in the face, I think, to the agency in this case, and I'm shocked they let it get to a decision, but there it is.